Hi, my name's Franny, and I'm an alcoholic. And my home group is Marina Pacifica Group, and my sobriety date is February 7th, 1970. Yeah. And, you know, has anybody else here ever noticed that the longer the guys get sober, the better their stories get? And have you also noticed that sometimes, in a majority of cases, although certainly not this weekend, the longer the women are sober, the more boring their stories get? And it's sort of like, you know, we clean up nicely, and you got these alcoholic broads, you know, that get sober, and they're not going to talk about what they did, you know. And so you go to some of these meetings sometimes, and these women talk, and they talk in great psychological generalities. And I've got 29 years of sobriety, and I'm sitting there as puzzled as the newcomer, saying, "What the hell was she saying there?" And I was like, you know, and the truth of the matter is that I think that the women do the new women a disservice by doing that. You can't tell me you're an alcoholic. You may be a first-class lady. But you know, you can't tell me you're a lady. You can prove you're a lady by your actions, but you don't have to act it, because in this program, we have to show that we have overcome, we have sublimated, we have transcended whatever it is that we did out there, and we need to offer that hope to the newcomers. And if we falsify that information, where are these girls going to go? You know, because the primary thing an Alcoholics Anonymous is the identification. And, you know, so I guess what I'm saying to you is, hold on to your seats, because I'm going to tell my story. I come out of the CIA, Catholic Irish alcoholic, you know, New York, father alcoholic, mother alcoholic, grandparents alcoholic. I'm just getting the statistics out of the way. We can get into the story, you know. I've been married 4 times. First one was normal. I couldn't stand him. He bored me to death. And the other 3 were all alcoholic, you know. Any man that really fascinated me was an alcoholic. You know, our eyes would lock across the room and we'd both be sunk, you know. And my kids. I have a daughter and 3 sons. My daughter goes to ACA because she doesn't want to admit she's like me. But all 3 of my sons are sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know? And all of them have families. And as a matter of fact, my youngest son is pregnant for the first time. And he's putting on more weight than his wife, you know? We're giving him some real teasing on that. And I'm surrounded by these people that are alive and getting on with their lives. And, you know, it's such a thrill because these were abused kids. And one of the things that my sponsor told me, my sponsor used to make me practice keeping my mouth shut. She said, "Franny," she said, "you can't be the one to help them. They have to be able to seek it out." And I don't know why I'm impelled to say this, so I suppose somebody in the room needs to hear it, but the simple truth about it is that if I did my mother thing and started trying to ram it down their throat, you know, the way you teach them to hold their fork or, you know, yes, ma'am and no, ma'am, and then they resist like hell because they're teenagers and they're trying to break those apron strings. She said, if you put this on them, they're going to resist you and they're going to be resisting the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So you keep your big mouth shut and let somebody else help them. And what happened was my husband did. And he's not their father. Although he is their father. I mean, my son said, you know, he said, "Carter's my dad." You know, and I don't know. There's just been a universal healing. I can say categorically that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, yes, we do become free from alcohol, but I'll tell you what, it gives us the opportunity to embrace life. And I think that that's the big thing for me. Because once you stop drinking, then you've got to live sober. And that's always been the problem for me. See, I never got drunk again without making a decision sober that I was going to drink. You know, when you get up in the morning, if you if if you just can't get to any booze that day, you're sober. When you make the decision, you're going to get more booze. And that's the kind of drinker I was. So I'm going to tell you my story. I only got drunk four times before I was 21. I only drank four times before I was 21. The first time I was a little kid, my sister and I were serving drinks at one of my father's fabulous parties, and I tasted one of the drinks. It was Manhattan. I thought it was pretty good. I was 5 years old, Annie was four. And so we went back to Daddy. We said, we can carry more drinks than that, and he thought it was funny. So he gave us each a full tray, with which, instead of making a right turn into the living room, we walked straight into the closet, and the two of us drank everything on our respective trays. Passed out under my mother's mink coat, and nobody could find us. I have to tell you, my father was a gangster, and my mother was a professor at Columbia University. And I was an intellectual thief, is what I was, you know. But anyway, at that time, my mother insisted on calling the police because the girls were gone, which upset my father terribly, but really upset his friends who were at the party. And so it broke up the party, and there was a big fight. Anyway, we came wandering out the next morning, sick, sober, sorry. What are you going to do? You got this 5-year-old. You're going to pick her up. You're going to put a little butt right here, and you're going to say, Franny, you got to cool it. You drink too much. What are you going to do? Nothing. My family did the thing our families all did in our neighborhood. We turned it into a funny story. And every time there was a family holiday, we would bust each other in the chops with the funny stories we would tell on each other. We never did it to my father. One of my boyfriends tried it one time, and my father threw the Thanksgiving turkey at him. So we knew you could bust everybody except Daddy. You know, we knew that. The kind of family I came out of was a couple of stories, then we'll get on. That way you'll know what the background is. You know, this is amazing. I listen to myself when I talk, and I wonder sometimes why some things come out of my mouth. And I think it's because I say a prayer before I get up here, and it's, Lord, fill my mouth with worthwhile stuff and nudge me when I've said enough, you know? And I sort of try to get quiet inside and say, you let me talk about whatever it is that somebody needs to hear. Because we'd need, like, the rest of the weekend if I was to tell you the real story. You know, so what we have to do is make some judicious choices and pull a little piece here and pull a little piece here and, you know, make it cohesive, which is another silly point. Because how many people here have less than a year? Give me your hands. Let me see. Oh, good. You're the ones, you know, just it's you and me, kid. You know, the rest of them. We get up here. I mean, we say it's not a psychological program. And then we get up here and we talk about things in a reasonable, logical, linear manner, as if we're explaining something. I gotta tell you, there's no explanation here. I'm up here telling you my story, and you're sitting there listening to it, and while we're busy just conversing with each other, we're giving God time to heal you. See, that's what it's all about. We gather together and love you, and God heals you. You know, and I'm hoping that we get a little entertainment out of this thing, and maybe some good ideas, but other than that, forget it. Because there are a lot of idiots in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you gotta protect yourself against them. I'm not kidding. I mean, maybe everybody's well here in Florida, but where I got sober, we had some sick buckos, I'll tell you. We, you know, and coming in as a newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no idea who was sick and who was well. I only knew I was attracted to whoever had a fast lip, you know. And they would get up at the podium sometimes, and they'd, like, lay some stuff out, and I would say, God, that's good. And I'd hear somebody behind me say, there's nothing of that in the book. So I found out, and I'm kept passing this on to the newcomers. If I don't give you anything else, get this. Get yourself a big book. Make sure you got one. And anytime anybody gives you a good idea, go and check and see if it's in the book. And the other thing is that when you find a sponsor, you know, you got to find somebody who's really worth your effort. And what I found out was I didn't want a liar and I didn't want a fool. So I didn't pick all the people that patted me on the back and said, gee, Franny, you're doing a good job. And I didn't pick any of those people that were out there playing this program like it was some kind of personality contest. I went for the one lady that scared the heck out of me. And for this, I am eternally grateful. I really am. Anyway, back to the story. The second time I drank, I was 14 years old, and that's the first time I ever saw the Al-Anon face. You know that look where they... and you don't know what to say. You wish you did. And they don't say anything. If they would only say anything, then you could say, at least defend yourself. But they don't. They just look at you. All I wanted to do when what happened was I got drunk and I got up the next morning and my mother's standing in the doorway of the bedroom smelling the puke because when I went to bed that night I was feeling a little sick and then I had to throw up and I couldn't find the door to my bedroom. I got lost in my bedroom and I tried to clean it up, but I have to tell you the truth, I only smeared it all over everything. And the next morning, my mother's there, and I looked at her, and she's got that great stone face, you know, and I'm thinking, oh, God. But I found out something that day. I found out I could outweigh anybody. Because I sat there looking back at her, because I didn't know what to say. It was not like a conscious decision. I just didn't know. I was blinded by the headlights, you know, that one. And she threw her hands up and started crying and walked away. And I had a small little germ of, like, triumph. Anyway, I shared that with my sponsor when I took my fifth step. And my sponsor said, well, I knew I was in trouble with that fifth step when she walked in with the big book and a box of Kleenex. But anyway, my sponsor shared things with me while I was sharing things with her. And she said, wait a second. She said, do you understand why that happened? And I said, no. I said, you told me that I was a pathological liar, and I was to make sure that besides following exactly what the book said, that I was to tell you all the things that I hid. And that's one of the things that I hid, because I never understood it. Now, I didn't care if you thought I was a sinner, but I didn't want you to think I was stupid. So I said, so I used to hide that. And it was like a sense of shame at the same time, yeah, I got one over on. And she said, Franny, she said, your mother walked into that room, and she was always already watching your father die of the disease, and she walks into the room, her oldest daughter, 14 years old, looks and smells just like him, and she knows you're on a downhill road starting right that day. And she said, how do you think your mother felt? She said, you know, she says, the agony that the Al-Anon feels when the alcoholic is on this road of self-destruction, she says, is inexpressible. There are no words for it. That's why they don't say anything. That's why they just look. And you know, it was at that moment that I realized I owed my mother more than a generic apology, like, gee, Ma, if I hurt you any time in our lives, I'm truly sorry. I knew that it was going to take a lifetime to pay that woman back for the stuff that I had put her through. And it was able to happen that way. That's later on. Okay, the third time I drank, I got drunk and I got pregnant. And you don't need the details. And the fourth time I drank, I got drunk and I got married. So, you know, I should have known I had a problem with booze. But if anybody said to me, Franny, why do you do the things you do? I would have had to say, hey, you know, anything worth doing is worth doing poorly in the beginning, and I need to learn how to drink. Because my idea of being an adult was not paying taxes, raise kids, and, you know, being a responsible human being. My idea of being an adult was being able to drink. I never defined it in any other terms than that. And I knew that was the reality for most of the people in my neighborhood, or it seemed to me that way. That guy that got me pregnant, we got married, we moved to North Hollywood. I don't know, a couple of years later, I found myself with 2.8 kids, a house with a white picket fence, a dog, a couple of cats. He would get in the car every day and drive downtown Los Angeles and be an L.A. fireman. You know, and the women used to have coffee klatches, and the other women used to serve coffee cake and coffee, and I was still desperately trying to be an adult, whatever that meant. I was trying for some element of sophistication that came right out of some magazine someplace. And I had no idea what it was. I didn't know how to be a big kid, but I tried. So when it was my time for coffee clutches, I used to serve cream sherry with these little biscuits. And I would serve the cream sherry in these little crystal glasses, and everybody thought I was wonderful. And all I remember really is that there was always this discomfort inside me, and that when everybody left, I would finish the cream sherry, and when my husband came home from work, I'd be on the couch checking my eyelids for light leaks. You know how that goes. And Mommy would have a headache, so he would take the kids down to McDonald's for hamburgers. And I don't know. You know, I didn't realize it, but actually that was the beginning of my family's accommodating to my disease. And it's amazing. It really is a slippery slope. You know, you start off by these little tiny decisions that we make every day. And it's always these little tiny decisions we make every day, and then somehow we find ourselves in hell. You know, I went from a nice, safe couch to sitting under the Redondo Pier fighting the rats off because it was safer there than any place else in my life. You know, I don't know how the deterioration happens any more readily than I know how the recovery happens, except that saying yes to my good ideas took me down and saying yes to the steps took me up. And that's as much as I know, really. I mean, I could stop right here. We eventually moved us and our four kids to Redondo Beach in California. And that's where I finally found, for the first time in my life, I was 25 years old, I found people that I could relate to. And I can tell you that the hippie movement started just south of the Redondo Pier. And I was there. And I learned how to... The police are blind, you know. They're blind and dumb. Because we actually believe that we could take a half-gallon bottle of red, cheapest red wine you could find, wrap it in a brown paper bag, and turn that into a Coke bottle. Come on, give me a break. You know, we used to dig a hole in the sand just before it got totally wet and just before it would, you know, dry, where it was damp and cool, and we would bury the wine in there, and we would chug off that all day down on the beach. And I thought I was providing a wonderful life for my kids because, you know, I was down there on the beach, and, yeah, I got drunk every day, and, yeah, I did stupid things like diving off the pier and losing my bathing suit and stuff like that. But my kids were running free on the beach, and isn't that a wonderful childhood? My kids were totally unsupervised, neglected, basically abandoned. There was a lady in our neighborhood that I didn't know for years, belonged to Al-Anon, and her kids played with my kids. And when I got the divorce, my husband fought me to try to... When he got the divorce, my first husband, tried to get the kids, and one of the pieces of evidence was that my kids went barefoot for days at a time, and the lady that witnessed against me was this woman that used to take care of my kids without me asking, simply because she didn't want her kids endangered. But what he didn't count on was that she was an Al-Anon, she was going to tell the truth, and she didn't take any sides. And so the lawyer asked her, he said, is it in fact the truth that this lady's children ran barefoot and unsupervised? And she said, yeah. She said, yeah, they ran barefoot unsupervised because they ran with my kids. And he looked at him and she said, all the kids in the neighborhood ran barefoot and unsupervised. We were beach people. And so she blew that evidence right out of the water. But anyway, he thought she was going to be righteous, and what she was practicing her own program. And I hate talking about this. One time, after I shared this, a lady sent me a postcard and said to me, you baby killer. It was a woman's handwriting, I knew that, but she said, you're a baby killer. You have no right telling your story. You should be in hell. It was, of course, unsigned. But anyway, this is that part of it. I was drunk, as always, and it was my son's birthday. He was 8 years old, my oldest son. And I was up on the pier at Tony's and drinking. Kids were running around down the beach. My husband had made me promise that the house would be clean. There would be a birthday party for Buddy that day, and I assured him that would be the case, except that when I went down to the pier with the kids in the morning and went up and started drinking, I was discussing the birthday party with the bartender, and, you know, eventually I forgot. And the next thing I remember is my husband dragging me off the stool in this restaurant and dragging me. Well, actually what he did was he went behind me and he would punch me on one side to steer me to the left, and then when I lost my course, he'd punch me on the other side. So all my best friends that were standing around the pier fishing and spitting watched him beat me up all the way down the Redondo Pier. And when we got to the end, the kids were standing there big-eyed watching Daddy getting Mommy down the end of the pier. And all of a sudden, I had a sense that this is not right. I don't want these kids seeing this. So I said, I pulled myself up and sort of like gathered, you know, that momentary, I wouldn't call it a moment of truth, but something happened, and I turned around to my daughter, and I pulled some money out of my jeans, and I handed them to her, the dollars, and I said, here, you guys buy some ice cream, and then you walk home, because we only live two blocks from the beach. I said, because I don't want you kids watching your father abuse your mother this way. And with that, he poured me into the car. And with that, we got home. And the next thing I remember, and I know it wasn't long after that, was I had the phone, and my daughter is saying, Mommy, please come down here real quick. I don't know what happened, but Buddy was sitting on the railing eating his ice cream, and he went over backwards into the water, and the lifeguards can't find him. So I know what it's like to get snapped into absolutely cold, operational, sober. All of a sudden, I was like totally, totally present. My husband is confused. He can't get it. And I grabbed him, and I ran out the door. I jumped into the car. He jumped into the car next to me because he still doesn't know what's going on. I drive the car back down to the beach, and I get out there, and I start running down that beach because I'm a better swimmer probably than anybody in this room other than Carter. And this big Samoan friend of mine, big as a mountain, just gets in front of me while I'm running down the beach. He gets in front of me, he grabs me, he flips me around, and he pushes me down in the sand so that I'm kneeling there, and he says, my God, Franny, don't you find him. And they came out carrying the body of Buddy and up to the hospital, and I'm standing outside the emergency room, and they've got him in on the resuscitation unit, and I've got my arms crossed, and I'm standing there on this wall, and my husband's standing on that wall, and the two of us are staring at each other, waiting to find out whether Buddy's alive or dead. And I gotta tell you, there's some stuff that goes through your head, because I share this part of the story, there are people who have shared some of their stuff with me on this kind of thing. And the first thing is that you start bargaining. Dear God, please, don't let this baby die because I'm an incompetent human being. Don't let him die because I'm a lousy mother. I mean, if there's any equity in the world whatsoever, if you're any kind of a God at all, take me because nobody benefits from my existence, and let him live because he loved life. And then you go into that really secret part of yourself that everybody has, and you bring out the biggest bargaining chip that you've got. And you say, please, God, let him live, and I will even quit drinking. And I got to tell you something. For alcoholics, that's the biggest bargaining chip you've got. But the interesting thing is, after we get sober, what's your chip, kids? See, I talk to Al-Anons about this. I say, what's your bargaining chip? They can come up with at least 12. They're good negotiators, you know? Bing, 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 bing. Oh, yeah, and then this and then that. And they got it. They got it. They got it knocked. But you talk to an alcoholic, and, you know, our chip is booze. And truthfully, I don't know what my biggest bargaining chip is today. Because that was always it. So, anyway, the doctor comes out and he says, well, before that, the one thing that when I look back on this, the one thing that seems so sad, is that my husband's standing against that wall and I'm standing against this wall. And we couldn't even meet each other in the middle and put our arms around each other and hold each other while we're waiting to find out. Because that's what my drinking and my behavior had done to that family. And this was the man that just a year prior to this stood in the kitchen crying folding and unfolding a kitchen towel and saying, who are you? Who are you? You're some kind of a devil. You have replaced my wife. Where is the girl I married? Where is the woman that's the mother of my children? Where's the lady that I want to grow old with? Because you are not her. I want you to get the hell out of my life and send her back to me. And I have to tell you, this man was an L.A. fireman, and they don't raise any wimps, those guys. They're heroes. But I was able to make that man cry without even thinking about it. Years later, I said to him, why did you fold and unfold that towel when you were talking to me? He says, Franny, if I put it down, I would have killed you. So this man that had that kind of emotional feeling about the family, about me, about the kids, stood on his wall and didn't make a move. He came to me a couple of weeks later and he said, here's the deal. He said, I talked to the psychiatrist that I've been sending you to. I talked to the psychologist. I talked to the family counselors. I talked to the priest up at the church. I talked to the doctor. I talked to everybody that has anything to say about you. He said, and the psychiatrist pulled your records out. You are a psychopathic deviant, and I'm not trusting my kids to you because you might murder another one of my children. I'm divorcing you, and I'm taking these kids away from you. Until that statement was made to me, I had no idea how much I cared for my own kids. And so I didn't want him to take the kids away. It had nothing to do with their benefit. I just didn't want him to take the kids. So I went out and I interviewed lawyers. I went to lawyers' offices and I interviewed them to find a lawyer that would help me keep the kids. And I finally found one that smelled like a newcomer. Now, this is not really thinking the thing through. This is what transpired based on my effort. And I found a lawyer that was a drunk. I hired him, I seduced him, I blackmailed him, and I forced him to bear false witness and provide false witnesses in a court of law, and I got the kids. And I used to say to people, you know, that's because I'm so hip, slick, and cool. And later on, I realized, we have no idea why things happen. We have no idea why we do things. We have no idea why other people do things. But I have to tell you that every one of us in our own weird way is an agent of God's desires. Our actions, whether we like it or not, are fulfilling something where they simply wouldn't happen. Because what I found out years later was that the reason I kept those kids was because they had the opportunity to watch me get sober, and when it was their time to need Alcoholics Anonymous, they knew where to go, and that was it. You know, so I'm claiming hip, slick, and cool. And, you know, they just had to watch me hit my bottom and start climbing up again. In order to, you know, provide for these kids, I had to find myself some kind of job. So with this keen intellect, and I have a fabulous education too, I do, I went out and I started looking for a job, and within a week I found the absolutely best job that I could have ever hoped for. I became a barmaid in a beer bar, and I called myself the day manager because I was the only one that worked there. And I had it good. Everybody else drank beer, and I used to drink scotch out of a coffee cup, you know, and it was cool. And I learned how to shoot pool, and I learned how to turn tricks in the back room, and I learned how to smoke marijuana, and I was just getting comfortable. I was just settling down into the ooze, you know, because I'm a bottom feeder, you know, and they talk about finding lower companions. Well, I was one. Oh, that's all I know. And I liked it. I liked being mean, and I liked being cruel, and I liked being vicious, and I liked being nasty, and I liked being able to walk over to the pool table with a pool cue in my hand and know that one of those guys acted up, he'd get it right in the teeth. And they knew it too. And that's the way I lived. And one day this guy came slithering in, and I watched him with absolute fascination. And he told me he was a German immigrant, and he told me he was a waiter up at Harry Tracton's plush horse. And, you know, he was a banquet captain. I went up there one day, and I saw him in action. And he was a good leader and a good organizer. But he was no German immigrant. He was an Oklahoma Indian. And but he had this German accent because he knew he made more money as a waiter with a German accent than he would being an Oklahoma Indian. And he'd absorbed that personality to the point where when he talked in his sleep, it was in German. But anyway, this guy fascinated me. He danced the way I did. He played pool the way I did. He was as much of a sleaze as I was. He was really hip, slick, and cool like I was. And one day he stole a credit card and asked me to go to Las Vegas and marry him. And God, when you got a winner like that, what do you do? You know? And we had another kid. And when that baby was about 6 months old, this guy, who I had carefully chosen as my partner in life, you know, is standing in the door looking at me with those black eyes saying, "I can't take your game, I'm gone." And I'm thinking to myself, what's going on here? I don't want to train another one. You know, I don't want to have to go to work again. Look, I don't have much of a requirement for a man. I really don't. He's got to be good-looking enough to be a nice ornament with me on his arm. He's got to be smart enough to hold down a decent job. And he's got to be dumb enough to put up with my game. That's all I ask, you know? And this guy filled it all. And he's leaving. So, at the same time, I knew better than to say anything at that minute because there was a different look in his eyes than I had ever seen before. So anyway, he walked out, and I'm thinking it over, and I'm trying to figure out, what am I going to do? And of course, you know, I'm drinking while I'm figuring this out, because I always thought better when I drank. And as a matter of fact, I also drank better when I thought, you know. So, but anyway, I got to thinking about it, and I said, I got to do something about this. And I remember that my mother used to call Alcoholics Anonymous and turn my father in. And he always got away just before they got there. But the thing I remember standing there as a little girl and watching this was that these two good-looking guys with the hats and the overcoats would be standing there at the door of our apartment in New York talking to my mother, and she'd start crying, and one of them would hand her a handkerchief, and she, you know, she got some tea and sympathy. And I thought, yeah, that's what I'll do. I'll turn them in. So I called up Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, I want to talk to the boss. Well, first, I asked the operator, I said, give me the number for Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, this was in 1967, and it wasn't as known, that's all I can figure. Of course, it was key in my life, but it wasn't known. So she gave me the number for the Manhattan Beach Alano Club. So I didn't know where I reached. All I know is I had a number, I dialed it, I said, I want to talk to the boss. And it must have been a newcomer that answered because he said, hey, this lady wants to talk to the boss. And there was a big fight at the other end of, give me that phone. No, you can't have it. Give me that phone. And finally, this one guy gets on and he says, hello. He says, our higher power isn't available to talk to you at this moment, but I am authorized to represent him in any matters concerning recovery or alcoholism. So I figured, okay, you know, if I didn't get the president, I got the vice president. That's all right. I don't like dealing with clerks. I never have. The first person on the counter never has my attention. And so anyway, I explained my situation to him, carefully indicating that, of course, it was him. But see, this guy was shrewd. He knew that we had a broad here who's talking about a husband who's a real drinker. But he, after 5 minutes on the phone with me, also knew he's dealing with an alcoholic female and she's right here. And a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. So he offered to send a car to pick me up. And I said, no, absolutely not, because I had no idea what was going to happen to me. And then I reconsidered it because what he said was, look, he says, you come on up here. He says, we'll have a cup of coffee. We'll talk about it. I'll give you some literature that'll absolutely, you leave it all over the house, it'll absolutely destroy your husband's drinking. He says, but what I want you to do is I want you to come up and I want you to meet some very nice people and we'll help you out. And I thought, okay. And I also started thinking about it. You know, it had been a long time since anybody offered to send a car for me. And as much as I loved my old man, a girl really has to think, look out for herself, you know? And I thought, if this guy has any interest in me at all, I'm not passing up on this opportunity. Because I didn't have a clue. I didn't have a clue, you know. And so I put on my 79-cent Zoris. I put on a pair of corduroy hip huggers with bell bottoms. I found them in my yard after a party. I have no idea who owned them, but I washed them, and they fit me, and that made them mine. I have no idea what the owner wore home, and I couldn't have cared less. I had a man's shirt that I had bought in Goodwill with a button missing, and I had a this is all camel-colored, and I had a camel-colored sweater that I had stolen from Goodwill because I couldn't afford to buy it. I had a broken nose with two black eyes. I don't know, it was months since I had last washed my hair. And I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous wondering if you were going to live up to my expectations. And I was a royal mess is what I was. And I had no idea how they knew I was a newcomer. And this guy named Frank P. was leading the first meeting. And you know what they did? They snookered me into the newcomers meeting at 7 o'clock on Friday night up at the Manhattan Beach Club. And I walked in there, and I put 25 cents worth of gasoline in that old beater that I used to drive. And I got myself there. And people were standing up around the podium, you know, the way they do all the old-timers. They're so comfortable and cool, you know. And the guy saw me, and he went like this, you know. He waved me over with his finger, and he put me right down in front. And then this guy, Frank P., started this ceremony, and he told the weirdest story I ever heard before or since. And the only thing I really remember about it is that when somebody ran away with the postman, everybody laughed. And when he talked about a house burning down, everybody was just rolling in the aisles. And there's something that I noticed about this meeting, and it was that you laughed the same time I did. And my immediate thought was, God, these people are sick. Because I knew I was inappropriate. I don't know about any of the rest of you, but I'm going to give you a test right now. Is there anybody here who has ever been in a movie theater where the funniest, most hysterical scene is going on up on that screen, and you're laughing, and you're rolling around, and you're scratching, and you're ha-haing and hee-heeing, and you suddenly realize yours is the only voice you hear in that theater? We are inappropriate people. And you guys were on the same, what do you call it? The same kind of a clock I was, you know? When we're out there drinking, and alcoholics are 5 degrees off center, and after we quit drinking, and after we work the steps, and after we really get our lives together, we're sober, 5 degrees off center. You know, we are. Yeah, we were talking about that. Sometimes you can express it in terms of we all have our demons. And sometimes it's just we're 5 degrees off center. That's all, you know. So anyway, the guy talks about all this stuff, and you're laughing, and I'm laughing, and we're just having a ball. And then he stops, and he says, well, okay. He says, enough with that. He says, let's have a question and answer period. And I knew that he had his shills in the crowd, and we were going to play Stump the Drunk, you know. So I also knew that I had to let you know who I was and what my intentions were. So my hand came shooting up. And don't forget, I'm drunk, out of my mind, I'm drunk. And my hand comes right up, and I say, how do I get my old man to stop beating me? And he says, wow, you know, I haven't had that problem since I stopped drinking. He says, but I'm going to ask Indian Jeannie to come up here to the podium, and I want Indian Jeannie to share her experience, strength, and hope with this lady. So Jeannie bellies up to the podium, and she says, my name's Jeannie, and I'm an alcoholic, and any son of a bitch that lays a hand on me now that I'm sober is going to get a knife right in the gut. And I said, Hot dog, these people have the answers. I stayed for that meeting. I stayed for the 8:30 meeting. I stayed for the 12 o'clock wrist slashers meeting, you know. You know, those midnight meetings have a real purpose. That's where you go and talk to your buddies about the relationship your sponsor told you not to get into. That's also the time when you go find the next one, you know? Oh, God, you know. Fortunately, most of us don't die when we make stupid mistakes. But anyway, so I mean, they poured me out of there at 2 o'clock, and I went home, and I went in my kitchen, and I found the biggest knife that I had, and I cleaned it up, and I polished it, and I put it right there on the counter, so when he came home, I could introduce him to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he came in, and I started on him, and I was going, I had him backed up in the corner with this, and he worked in restaurants. We had all restaurant tools in our kitchen, you know, vegetable knives this long, you know. Had him backed up in the corner. I'm going, blah, 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 blah. I'm a child of God, and blah, 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 blah. I'm an alcoholic. Blah, blah, blah. He didn't know what the heck was going on, you know. And I pulled the knife away to get some feedback, and he couldn't talk when I had him like that, you know. And he was, I said he was a drunk. I didn't say he was stupid. Man, he split, you know. And he stayed away all weekend. And what happened was I was able to go to every meeting I could go to. And then some fool said to me, find the people you identify with. Listen, anybody I identified with was in deep trouble, you know. But I did find the people I identified with, and pretty soon we're standing outside the club, popping our fingers and dragging our heels and being hip, slick, and cool, while all the rest of the idiots are going in and going upstairs for the noon meetings or the evening meetings or whatever. And my little group were good, bad examples. We would periodically take turns getting drunk and going out and disappearing for a while and then dragging our sick, sorry selves back, you know? And what happened was, without ever stopping going to meetings, I didn't hit my bottom for 3 years. I also didn't stay sober for 3 years. I went to meetings drunk. I had no place else to go. In my heart of hearts, I knew Alcoholics Anonymous was the only possible answer for me, but my will said I was going to find a way to do it my way. And the other thing is that people in this program say this. I think it should be in the book, but it's not. You're only as sick as your secrets. And see, I had some secrets. One of my secrets was, I'm the one who killed my kid. And I wasn't going to tell anybody. Because I knew that if I told any of you people, even part of my story, that you would go and talk to your committee, and somebody would come and say, hey, Franny, come here. Look, as far as alcoholism and as far as recovery from alcoholism, Alcoholics Anonymous has obviously the best percentages and the best odds in favor of the alcoholic who wants to recover. But, honey, we deal with human beings, and you got to go. See, and that's what I knew would happen if I let you know who I was. I was not candid about anything. I was always on guard. And I was having real problems because I would come to meetings drunk and people would try to talk to me. And they would say, let's go for coffee after and, you know, we'll talk. And I knew what that meant. You would go and we would go for coffee. You'd pay for it because I couldn't. Maybe you'd buy me a meal. And then you would tell me a little bit about your story. And then you'd sit there waiting for me to tell you mine. And see, I wasn't going to tell you who I was. I just wasn't going to do it because I didn't want you kicking me out. And so what happened was I got sicker and sicker and sicker. And I was using excuses like, well, I really can't get involved with that, my husband or my kids, you know, or whatever it was. And what happened was eventually the husband wasn't there. Alcohol is a wonderful solvent. Whatever the objection is that the newcomer has, you keep drinking and it will dissolve any of those social reasons you can't do in Alcoholics Anonymous. They'll disappear. So the husband wasn't there anymore, and the kids were being taken care of by somebody else. And I don't know, I didn't have that car anymore, and people were coming and picking me up and taking me to the meeting, but they weren't trying to 12-step me anymore. They would just pick me up in total silence, dead hard silence in the car. They would drop me off at the club. They'd drive around and park, and I'd see them in the meeting. They wouldn't even recognize me. They didn't even try to 12-step me. And eventually reached the point where the only thing I did was sit in the halfway room, and then they would come and say, come on upstairs to the meeting, and then they would say, okay, go back there. And nobody called on me. They told me they weren't going to call on me because I was a hostile bitch and I scared the newcomers. And there was this one lady that scared me, and she was always surrounded by people that were having fun, she and her husband, Dan and Dottie, and they were always, you know, they were surrounded by these jive artists, and you know, they'd all come in and they went to see Hair and they were doing all this stuff, you know, and God, I would sit there and I would hate them not because of anything they did, but because of what I assumed they were. And the reason I hated them was because I couldn't have that. You know, and that's the way we are. We hate whatever we can't have that we want. And so I hated her and this resentment kept building and building and building, and I was really going to tell this woman off. I was really going to let her know what I thought of her and her phony husband that stood up at the podium jingling his money. One time, he gave a little pitch, and he's standing there in his new silk suit and is looking cool. And then she got up and she said, not if you want what we have. And I looked at him and I said, well, maybe. Because that was the level that I was working at. So anyway, one night after the young people's meeting on Sunday night, I walked up to her and I said, I want to talk to you. And she said, yeah, what do you want? And I said, I was really going to let her have it. And I said, I want you to be my sponsor. You know, and I was like, where did that come from? That was not my intention. And she looked at me and she said, God, Franny, I don't know. You're a loser. And I said the one thing that saved my life. I said the one thing I hadn't said to another human being in 25 years. I looked her right in the eye, and I just stood there, and I said, please. And in doing that, I stepped out of being the center of my universe. I stepped out of being the ruler of all I surveyed. I finally got out of the position of being my own higher power. In asking her into my life, I stepped aside, and when I stepped aside to have her come in, God stepped into my life. See, he doesn't need permission. And so what happened was she said, well, and she put her hand up, and one of her lieutenants gave her a directory, you know, just like that. And she took it, and she marked the meetings she went to. She said, these are the meetings I go to. I'll see you there. And she walked away. So I went to those meetings, and I stayed as far away from her as I possibly could. I have to tell you another thing. I want to make this real fast, is that at the time that I got sober, we had a bunch of stupid old people that were standing around saying, and we will not talk about drugs. And so I never told anybody that I was on speed. They said, you won't talk about drugs? Fine, no problem. And I wonder how many we killed. You know, I was too dumb to leave. You know, but I wonder how many we killed with that kind of an attitude, because that's part of my bottom. I mean, we talk about screw it people left and right, you know, and then it's like there's a little paranoid position going on there, and I don't need to get into that. You can examine your own inventories, you know. But anyway, so I never told anybody that I took speed. But I also knew that some way, somehow, I was going to have to get off that, because I heard people talking about things like embracing sobriety and, you know, anything from the neck up and all that stuff. And I thought, well, you know. And I would get up and I didn't put scotch in my coffee anymore, but I would drop a half a roll of Benny's and start my next day of sobriety that way, you know. And I was in bed one morning real, real early, still carefully avoiding this woman. And the phone rang, and I had my head under the pillows, and I was screaming because I didn't want to get up. I didn't want to face another day. But I had to answer the phone, so I threw the pillow aside, and I, hello, you know. And she said, hi, Franny, how are you? It was her. And I said, oh, I'm fine. And she said, you know, you're such a liar. She said, tell me something. Have you stopped taking speed yet? Now, how did she know? And I said, oh, yeah, that's out of the picture. She says, good. She said, when did you quit? And I went, this morning. She didn't bat an eye. You know, she said, she's so cool. She said, okay. She said, good. She said, here's what I want you to do. She says, I want you to start coming over to my house every day because we have a whole bunch of sober people coming in and out of the house all the time. There's no reason for you to be at your house. She said, because you only get in trouble if you've got yourself or your company. And she says, you come on over here and you start watching us and you start learning how people do sober. So I went over to her house and I thought we had to talk, and she said, no, Franny, she says, we don't have to chat. She says, you sit over there and just watch. And I said, oh, okay. And it was like, it was such a relief, you know? And I eventually started helping her clean up her house and, you know, just do little things. But most of the time what I did was I covered myself with a blanket and I lay in the corner of the dining room with my feet straight up the wall as far as I could get into the corner. Nobody saw me that way. And I used to listen to all these conversations that went on around the dining room table about sobriety, about 12-stepping, about working with others, about how you pay amends and what you mean I'm supposed to pay money back to. You know, and all that stuff that we go through and that we find out about when we're new. And how do I pick out a newcomer? I mean, how do I pick out a sponsor? And it just went on and on. And I'm sitting there like a sponge absorbing all this hidden under my blanket. And one time, two of my girlfriends and I decided that we were going to go out to a dance, and we had to borrow everything we wore. And but we also stopped by after the dance to show Dottie and Dan how really cool we were, you know. And we came walking in all our borrowed finery, and he looked up. He was reading a book or something, and he said, ha, ha, there they are, slick, trick, and sick, you know. And... At another time I went to Dottie and I said, must I remain celibate for the rest of my life? I said, Ellie's got a sponsor and Susie's got a sponsor and Janet's got a sponsor and where's mine? And she said, Franny, she said, God's giving you this time alone so that you can really work on the steps, so that you can develop a program that's going to save your life. And anyway, any guy that's interested in you isn't worth your time. Okay, yeah, that's true. I could buy that because I knew what a sick cookie I was. So she told me, she said, don't hang around with the guys that are interested in you. She says, stick with the bunch that's walking the way they're talking. You know, hang with us, go to the movies with us, find out what it's like to have a man for a friend. Stop abusing the guys. And you know what I found out? I had come into this program looking for Uncle Daddy. I knew that if I could find the right man, good-looking enough, smart enough to hold a job, and stupid enough to put up with my stuff, that was really all I needed. And I have to tell you, that's probably the attitude of 100% of the single women that come into this program. And unfortunately, there's enough of you dumb bunnies out there that you go for it. And you see, it's not the girls that get destroyed. The guys. Because the women, when the guy falls, you don't know, after I've been sober for a while, I used to have guys come up to me when we lived up in South Bay. I haven't quite got my reputation yet in Long Beach. But I used to have guys that would come up to me in South Bay and they would say, please, will you talk to Susie? She's a year and a half sober. We've been together a year and a half and she's driving me crazy. And I said a couple times to these guys, I said, you realize, of course, that if I talk to this woman and she starts developing some principles, she's probably going to leave your sleazy ass. And here's the interesting thing. I would say 50% of the guys say, yeah, please, I want to see her get help. And the other 50% walk away. They turn on their heels and they walk away because they would rather keep that sick broad where she's available than watch her turn into a human being. You know, that's sad. But that's also the facts. And so, you know, every area, every group needs some kind of dragon lady, I guess. Anyway, I started working the steps, and I started working them as hard as I could because I was sick. And what happened was this little broad came to me and said to me, will you be my sponsor? She said, I've been trying to talk everybody else into it, and nobody wants to touch me. And I don't blame them. You know, she was sick. little Indian gal. So I said, well, Becky, hang on a second. I said, you stand right there. And I put her right down there, and I ran over because I went to the meetings my sponsor goes to. And I said to Dottie, I said, Dottie, Becky asked me to be your sponsor. What should I do? She said, Franny, you stay one step ahead of her. She'll never know the difference. And so with 9 months of sobriety, I started sponsoring. You see, I got a big mouth, and I got opinions, and I'm willing to stand up to somebody. And so some of the women were asking me to sponsor them because, you know, we all come in needing, we don't need to be exploited. We need protection. And they figured, well, if they can't ask a guy, ask the biggest girl there. So, you know, that's what they did. And I started sponsoring people. And you know what happened? I started getting well, because what happened is when you got babies that are walking along behind you as close as we followed each other, boy, you better walk the way you talk or they're going to call you on it right now. And it was sponsorship that really got me going in the program. It was sponsorship that started me having to practice these principles in all my affairs. I had to stop lying. You know, there was a textbook called The Roman Catholic Church and Psychopathology. And according to that book, as a psychopathic deviant, I had been born without a soul. So I figured I had no value whatsoever. And one time I went to Dottie and I said to her, you know, I hate you. I hate this program. I hate this book. I hate everything in it. And she looked at me and, you know, she was no longer intimidated by my drama. And she said, what are you talking about? I said, look, it says right here, there are people who are incapable of being rigorously honest, you know, like that. And she said, yeah, but she said, if you just read the black part of the page instead of the white part, it only says your chances are less than average. It doesn't say you can't get it. She says, it just means you got to work harder. I said, you mean I have a chance? She says, yeah, but you really have to work harder. I said, I can do that. And that's one of the reasons that I was where I was at, was sponsoring women and going to as many meetings and really working the steps hard. I wound up meeting a guy in the program. I wound up traveling all over the world with him. I wound up watching him go on marijuana maintenance. And I watched a wonderful human being turn into a worm. Finally, one day, in the middle of a snowstorm in Iowa, he made an offer to me where he was going to continue marijuana and continue with the girls that he was connecting himself with, and that I could stay home and be mommy, but I would have security. And I said to him, is that your best offer? And he said, yeah. And I said, you know what? It goes completely against my principles. It's not good enough for me. And I walked out of that relationship, and that's the first time in my life that I ever actually acted on the principle that my sobriety has to come first before anything else. Because it was always important for me to have a man around. In this case, what I said was, okay, God, don't let me get us into anything you can't get us out of. And I walked out of that relationship, and I came back to California, and my mother had cancer, and I started taking care of her. And one day, my mother was sitting in the bed, and she said, gee, I'd sure like a cup of tea. And I went and I got her a cup of tea, and I fixed it up for her. And we both knew she was dying, and I had been with her for about 9 months. And I gave her the cup of tea, and I was sitting there on the bed and talking to her, and she's stirring the tea, and she says, she looks at me. Now, she had 9 years of sobriety at that time with the same sponsor that I had. And I was not the first one that she asked for help. When she got cancer, she asked my sister Pat. Pat was too busy. She asked my sister Ann. Ann was too drunk. So she had to resort to me, and I was the one that was like the furthest away from her emotionally, but I was the one that said yes. So I'm sitting there on the bed, and she's stirring the cup, and she says, you know what? I said, what? She says, finally, I've got you just where I want you. And I started laughing because I knew exactly what she was talking about. And when she died, we were friends. She gave me the privilege of walking her through what she endured. She taught me how to deal with life a day at a time with grace and dignity. I had an opportunity to be her friend, and we were good friends by the time she died. There was a guy that was in the group, and he came to the funeral, and he'd been a friend of mine for a year. And I was divorced from husband number three, and I didn't care if I ever met a man again. I just didn't care. all I wanted to do was be sober and make some kind of decent living and raise my kids. And what happened was, he asked me to go down to Laguna Beach with him, and I thought, yeah, fine, lunch would be fine. You know, walk along the beach, who knows what. But anyway, he kidnapped me for a weekend. And it was sort of fun, and you don't need the details. And what happened was, on Sunday morning, we were walking along the beach, and I looked out on that Pacific water, and I hadn't been to the beach in years and years and years. Like I said, I'm a swimmer. So anyway, I took off my watch and I took off my earrings, and he's standing up on a rock, and I handed them up to him. I said, hold on to this. And I walked into the water, and I said to myself, you're an idiot. He's going to think you're crazy. He's one of the nicest guys you've ever met. You're really screwing this up, Franny. But it was like I couldn't stop myself. I went into the water, and I felt like I was being baptized. And I swam under the kelp, and I swam all the way out, and I came up, and I was just out there, and it was just absolutely fabulous. And all the time, you know, I'm just enjoying the sun and the touch of the water and everything else. I'm saying to myself, okay, now he knows what an idiot you are. Well, you screwed up this one, didn't you, right? Yeah, okay, so what? Anyway, I swam in again, and I came up on the beach, and he came running down the beach, and he grabbed me, and he swung me around, and he stopped, and he said, wow, 5 years looking through the horse shit, and I finally found the pony. And that's my husband over there, you know, and, you know, I told him, I said, you know, the reason God put me into your life is so that you would have an opportunity to work a sterling program. And what we found out is that in a relationship in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's not about what you can get out of it. It's about you have chosen a teacher that you are going to learn from if you're willing to stick. And there aren't that many successful relationships. I cherish the relationships and the friends that I have that are sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I cherish the fact that there are people who are partners. I want to know those people because I don't want to hang with the losers. And I have so much to learn about being a friend and about being a wife. And so I always go where those people are. Where I am today is I went to Carter. You see, I have a degree in psychology. I also have a degree in sociology. I also have a degree in theater. I was a pig when I went back to school. And I went to Carter, and I was very successful working in the corporate world, and I said, you know what, this is fine, but what I really want to do is I want to work in the theater. And he asked me the most profound question anybody has ever asked me. He said, well, whose permission are you waiting for? And I realized I was doing it to myself again. So what I wound up doing is I wound up going to Cal State and going for my master's degree in scenic design in the theater. And I'm doing shows in Hollywood, and I'm agonizing over every one of them, and I have learned a discipline that applies to every, you know, it's always, if you don't learn the discipline, you're not going to get the thing. You're not going to get the deal. There is always an underlying foundation of discipline that has to be exercised in order for you to get any kind of benefit out of anything. I don't care what it is. And I know that I can plan sets in my head until the cows come home, until I start picking up a pencil and start working it out on paper. Nothing is happening. See, and what I want to do is I want to conceive it in here and then walk away having done it. And it doesn't happen that way. And you don't do life that way either. It's like, I don't care what it is, there's some kind of effort. And so what happened was I've been making the effort, and it's been quite successful. It's interesting. My kids gave me, my kids are friends. I already told you that. And for my birthday, I was 65 last May 29th. What happened was I had hip surgery. I've had a total hip replacement exactly 95 days ago. And, I'm not supposed to be pigeon-toed. It's like I can't do that. And I can't do that. So going in the water yesterday was really a thrill. And what happened is my kids for my birthday gave me Italian lessons because next year in the millennium I'm going to Florence and I'm going to be there for 9 months and I'm going to be working on an opera and I'm going to be studying and I'm going to be teaching and I got to learn Italian to do that. So I'm doing it. And I got a good accent and I can't remember the vocabulary. It's going to be interesting. Anyway, you know, that's where my life is. I don't have to tell you what it's like. We've all been together for this weekend. We've been laughing and scratching and kicking around, enjoying each other. And there's a skit at 3 o'clock that I want to see, and I know you do too. And I don't want you to end this meeting before I do, so I'll shut up. Thank you very much.